If he wanted to make a distinction between sex, as in male and female, and something else, if you wanted to distinguish, for example, being female from being feminine, or being female from obeying society's rules for females, or something like that, then, like, the worst possible word to pick to make that distinction would have been gender.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Daum. Quick announcement to let you know that if you are a founding member of this podcast, we will be having a Zoom hangout on Sunday, March 17th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific time. We haven't done one in a while, and I owe you one. So that is when it will be. And of course, if you are a regular paying subscriber, which is great, by the way, thank you, and you want to upgrade to founding member so you can enjoy this perk, you can do that at any time by going to megandaum.substack.com and upgrading your membership. Okay, my guest is Alex Byrne. Alex is a professor of philosophy at MIT who, until recently, was an innocent man, just a simple philosopher of epistemology and metaphysics. But a few years ago, he became interested in, wait for it, gender. And he wrote a book about it. It's called The Trouble with Gender, and it covers a lot of things. But above all, it wrestles with the linguistic confusion of gender. What does the word even mean? What did the philosopher Judith Butler, whose 1990 book Gender Trouble kicked off decades of debate and cognitive distortions, mean when she said sex was different from gender? What about social scientists like Anne Fausto Sterling, who came up with the idea that there are five sexes? Alex discusses all of that in this interview. He also talks about how the UK acquired the nickname Turf Island, about the ordeal of getting this book published, and what it's like to be married to another controversial researcher of gender, the evolutionary biologist Carol Hooven, who wrote an entire book about testosterone, and who recently paid us a visit in the Unspeakeasy online community, as it happens. A quick note here, Alex's book does not have much to do with youth gender medicine. At least that's not the focus. As you may know, if you follow this issue, last week, a bit of a bombshell dropped in that world, having to do with leaked documents from the World Professional Organization for Transgender Health, or WPATH. This conversation was recorded before that happened. I'm sure I'll be talking about the WPATH thing in the future. This just doesn't happen to be the week. As always, paying subscribers will hear this entire interview. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, you will hear the first 45 minutes or so. To hear the rest, again, go to megandaum.substack.com and become a paying supporter. And with that, here's my conversation with Alex Byrne. Alex Byrne, welcome to The Unspeakable.
Megan, thanks very much for having me.
You are a professor of philosophy at MIT. Your fields of research include things like philosophy of mind, especially perception and consciousness, epistemology, metaphysics, especially color. So here's my first question. Why in God's name did you decide to get mixed up in the new gender debate?
Oh yeah, that is an excellent question. I mean, I'd led a pretty blameless life.
Oh, I thought you were going to say boring. Then you
didn't. No, well,
you wanted
to
do something.
Both boring and blameless. And I mean, even my philosophical views are pretty boring. I mean, you mentioned that I'm interested in color, and my main thesis about color is that tomatoes are red and grass is green.
Okay, but that...
I managed to get tenure for that, basically.
You got tenure for that?
Yeah, basically. I mean, that is actually very controversial within philosophy. And the funny thing is, it's also controversial outside philosophy. As soon as you like start to talk to ordinary people about colors and whether things really have the colors they seem to have, they very often spontaneously voice the opinion that colors are somehow all in the mind and that color perception is really just this sort of gigantic impressive illusion that we're all subject to. So the tomato doesn't really have the redness that you see. It just has the property of reflecting light of certain wavelengths and not others. Anyway, so I did nothing controversial until I waded into the sex gender debate. And I think I'd always been interested in sex differences. I mean, who isn't? And then in 2017, this junior philosopher, Rebecca Tuval, published this paper, In Defense of Transracialism, which appeared in the leading, I'm sure you've heard of all this, the leading journal of feminist philosophy, Hypatia. And in that paper, Rebecca was comparing Caitlyn Jenner, who'd just come out on the cover of Vanity Fair a couple of years before, to Rachel Dolezal, the woman who was, I think, head of the NAACP in Spokane, Washington, and was rather tanned and claimed to be black. And then it turned out that she was born of white parents, and everyone poked fun at her. And Rebecca's point, it all sounded terribly progressive, was that, you know, we should extend the same courtesies to transracial people like Rachel Dolezal that we do to transgender people like Caitlyn Jenner. And perhaps predictably, this provoked a huge storm of protest. It was absolutely amazing. The most amazing thing was that a lot of the protest was from her own colleagues in philosophy, and indeed a couple of members of her own faculty members who were on her own PhD dissertation committee turned against her, and there were demands for the paper to be retracted. And there was an open letter signed by hundreds of people saying that, of course, all this was terribly damaging and disgraceful and accusing Tuval of various crimes. That really piqued my interest. And then, sorry, just to skip ahead a year, these issues became much more salient to me, or even more salient to me, when Kathleen Stock intervened in the sex gender debate. That was around 2018.
Right, right. And Kathleen has been on this show as well as on my other show, A Special Place in Hell. I actually want to pause here in 2017, because I remember when the Rebecca Tuval thing happened. I was actually teaching myself at that time. I was a visiting professor at the University of Iowa.
Oh,
I made the mistake of trying to speak to my students about this. But let's. I would love for you to explain what was the climate like in philosophy at that time. I mean, we should say so. It's Rachel Dolezal was, like you said, she was a leader at the NAACP in Spokane. You know, she had obviously some mental health issues kind of on
yes,
top of everything else. And,
right.
But like, you know, she's a lay person. I was a little bit surprised that an academic philosopher would write a paper about somebody like Rachel Dolezal, like, you know, and also I guess somebody like Caitlyn Jenner, just like sort of in the pop culture. So, I mean, first of all, were you surprised that an academic philosopher would write about these kinds of folks? And then I want to ask you just about like whether you were surprised about the response from other philosophers.
Oh, right. So on the first question, no, I was not surprised at all. And Rebecca was not really writing about these two individuals in particular. They were just useful examples.
Right.
So she was just picking up something that was already very much alive in popular discussions of Caitlyn Jenner and Rachel Dolezal. I mean, when these two characters appeared, people naturally made the comparison or asked the question, well, you know, if Rachel Dolezal is so obviously not black, why is it so obvious that Caitlyn Jenner is a woman? Or alternatively, since we treat forget whether she is a woman, since we treat Caitlyn Jenner as a woman, why on earth can't we treat Rachel Dolezal as black? And Rebecca was just taking up these questions, which kind of ordinary non-philosophers were asking, and subjecting it to a philosophical treatment. And that kind of thing happens all the time in philosophy, and it sounds like a very good thing. You know, you're taking up some question that ordinary people are interested in, and giving it the benefit of your philosophical expertise.
Yeah. And I don't remember her as even endorsing anything in particular. She was just saying, like, well, if we're going to look at this like this, why don't we look at this like this?
Sure.
Like, it was, you know, what is a construct? If gender is a social construct, isn't race, which race is more of a social construct than sex, but I will
well,
get into that.
That's the funny, right. I mean, that's some very strange asymmetry, which we will no doubt get to later.
Right. Yeah. But were you, okay, so, I mean, because what I hear from philosophers a lot, and Kathleen talked about this when she was on, you know, the philosophers will talk about anything. I mean, you could have conversations about like the most outlandish, you know, shocking, taboo kind of conundrum. And that's like all part of the fun. And suddenly the climate had changed. Was it around a racial reckoning? I mean, this was 2017, so we were not yet into, you know, the thick of things. But what was what do you think was driving some of this reaction?
Well, I think, of course. I mean, Michael Brown was in Ferguson. That was 2014.
Okay,
so
that's true.
Admittedly, we hadn't got to George Floyd yet, but race, of course, was very much a third rail topic, and at the time, trans issues were pretty third rail as well. And I think, I mean, I don't know whether this is a really satisfactory answer to your question, but it was just that, like, when the two of them collided, it made for such a combustible collision that. I mean, I think, you know, sort of there was just room for everyone to be outraged.
Yeah, there had something for everyone.
Trans people to be outraged, for black people to be outraged, for various allies to be outraged. And of course, notable that she was writing in Hypatia, the leading journal of feminist philosophy. And there is one area of philosophy which is reliably woke, and that is feminist philosophy. So, you know, they tend, unlike almost any other area of philosophy, feminist philosophy, for good or ill, tends to be somewhat intolerant of dissenting views. And this was held to be very much a dissenting view.
Right.
I mean, also, sorry, I can elaborate just a little bit more. So as soon as you start comparing sympathetically transracial people and transgender people, then you are suggesting that whatever's true of transgender people is also true, with suitable adjustments, of transracial people. So if Caitlyn Jenner is a woman, by parity of reasoning, Rachel Dolezal is black, or if we should treat Caitlyn Jenner as a woman, then by parity of reasoning, we should treat Rachel Dolezal as black. Certainly the progressive view at the time, which is still the progressive view, is that this kind of parity is absolutely unacceptable. It's just completely wrong. There is a massive asymmetry between, it's chalk and cheese. Caitlyn Jenner is a woman and should be treated as a woman. Rachel Dolezal is not black and should be made fun of.
So your book really focuses on foundational questions. You know, you're joining now like a growing canon of gender books in this moment, and they all kind of do different things. How do you characterize your book? What are you bringing to the table that's new and different?
Okay, so most of the books so far, in fact, maybe all of the books so far, largely or significantly focused on social and political and policy issues. So that goes for Helen Joyce's Trans and Kathleen Stock's Material Girls. And in the case of Material Girls, that's tied, the book is tied quite closely to the UK context. And I thought I could write a book that didn't take a stand on any of these social, political questions, trans women in sports or trans women in the female prison estate or self-ID or gender-affirming care, but instead concentrated on these questions which are asked interminably on the internet what is a woman? Is sex binary? What's the difference between sex and gender? And then I ended up throwing in some stuff about patriarchy and identity and the true self, which is quite salient in the trans context. And there's a chapter on gender identity. You know, do we all have a gender identity? Is a mismatch between one's gender identity and one's sex body responsible for gender dysphoria? That kind of thing. So that is the sort of content of the book. And then I thought, I'm in a somewhat privileged position, having been born in the UK and having kept in touch with gender development on Turf Island, I thought I could write a book that sort of straddled the Atlantic and would be appealing to both Americans and Brits.
Yeah, I don't know why it's easier to talk about this in the UK than in the US. The Turf Island refers to the UK and the sort of conversation going on there.
Yes,
what is it that you guys are getting? Why are you getting away with this? Why are they? I know you're an American now.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether they are getting away with it exactly. Of course, you know, Kathleen was well and truly cancelled, and J.K. Rowling has had an enormous amount of abuse thrown at her. Of course, she's really the queen of Turf Island. And I mean, I think the whole trans thing started very differently in the UK. So it started because the then conservative, its centre-right government proposed to reform the 2004 Gender Recognition Act, and the reform would have ushered in a form of self-identification. So now you don't have to jump through all these hoops to have your gender kind of officially, legally reassigned. You can just sign a form, pay a small fee. You don't have to be certified by some panel of doctors or anything like that. And a whole bunch of women, many quite left-wing and from the trades union movement, were very annoyed at this proposal and didn't like it at all and pushed back and formed all sorts of associations to resist. I mean, one was called Women's Place UK, to resist the reforms. So it all started as this movement to push back against, this sort of genuinely grassroots movement to push back against legislation. And of course, politically, if anything, it was the exact mirror image of the situation in the US, where it's the right wing that's associated with turfery and the left wing that's associated with
being an ally.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, right.
So that's fascinating. Right. So it was really coming out of a grassroots feminist.
Oh yeah, totally. Right. And a bunch of these, right. I mean, a lot of these women were self-identified feminists and had, you know, in some particular cases, I mean, extremely impressive feminist credentials. I mean, one example is the writer Julie Bindle, who'd been working, you know, whose sort of life's work has been campaigning against male violence against women. So. Yeah, on the one hand, it was grassroots, and then strikingly, it's just politically the mirror image of how it
is. Yeah, because here
in the
US, it's all
things
are entangled in gay rights here.
Yeah, and things are much more politically polarized in the US than in the UK, anyway.
Your book is called Trouble with Gender. Obviously, that's a twist on Judith Butler's seminal, so to speak. Gender Trouble.
Nice word.
When did that come out? 1990? Okay.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I didn't realize that Judith Butler was actually as young as she is. I remember when she came up on the scene, I was in college, and I just sort of assumed that she had been around forever. But she was a new, you know, kind of exciting upstart philosopher. And she really is the cause of so much of this because she is the one that decided we were going to talk about sex and gender as two distinct things. Now, my sort of, you know, just back pocket description of her belief is that gender is a performance of the sex that you are, and sex is your biological sex. So if you are a woman, your sex is a woman, your gender is the performance of femininity or the performance of masculinity. Okay. So is that, where does that definition kind of stand at this point?
Okay, so I don't think that's actually quite right.
I'm sure it's not.
I mean, you can hardly be blamed. You can hardly be blamed for getting it wrong, and maybe there is really no sense in which you could get Judith Butler right. But I mean, I think the first thing you said about the distinction between sex and gender. So that was, I mean, there are a number of, like, so many ironies in this. In this whole subject. So one irony is that even though the sex gender distinction was taken up with great gusto by second wave feminists in the 1970s, it was in fact invented by a man.
Oh.
So the first person who really clearly made a distinction between sex and gender using those very words was the UCLA psychiatrist Robert Stoller in a book called Sex and Gender that he published in 1968. And there, the sex gender distinction was the distinction, you basically described it, it's just the distinction between biological sex, male and female, and gender understood as masculinity and femininity. And, yeah, I mean,
okay.
He didn't say anything about performance, but, you know, obviously it makes perfect sense to think of someone as, you know, performing masculinity, you know, that how masculine you are presentation-wise is something very much under your control, not totally under your control. I mean, do you remember this meme, Giga Chad, he's called? it's just he's apparently some real guy, some impossibly square-jawed, masculine looking guy. Anyway, there's okay. No way he
on,
could...
On
he
every could incel's vision board.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. There's no way he could perform femininity very, very, very convincingly. But, you know, for most of us, you know, we can perform... If we're male, we can perform masculinity more or less convincingly. And even if we're male, we can sometimes perform femininity more or less convincingly. Anyway, that was Stoller's distinction. And then feminist theorists of the 1970s seized on that, sometimes subtly adjusting the meaning of the word gender in the process. For example, using it to stand for a system of gender norms or rules that males and females are supposed to follow in society. You know, there's an appropriate way of behaving if you're a male, an appropriate way of behaving if you're a female. And that's what at least some of them called gender. And then Butler came along in 1990, and one of the things she did was to argue, or at least to claim, that sex was no more a biological given than gender is. Sex is just as socially constructed, to use a very unclear but somehow resonant phrase. Sex is just as socially constructed as gender. So I think at one point in Gender Trouble, she says, oh, well, so maybe there really is no distinction between sex and gender. Maybe sex was gender all along. So, you know, on her view, biological sex is some kind of illusion engendered by certain social practices, maybe including the practice of labeling babies male or female at birth. That gives us the illusion that there's like something out there, these biological sexes that have nothing to do with society, but in reality, it's just a social practice all the way down. So one thing she did was, in that sense, overturn the sex-gender distinction. And then, now turning to the gender side, it is very unclear what she means by gender. She means a bunch of different things by gender throughout Gender Trouble and elsewhere in her work. But one thing that she does mean occasionally is man and woman. So talking about gender is to talk about men and women. men and women are gender categories. So in this use of gender, if I ask you, what is your gender? The true answer is woman. The true answer is not female. The true answer is woman. Okay, so then, just to get to the performative bit, one of the things she seemed to be saying when she said that gender is a performance is that to be a woman is to act and behave in a certain way. That's what it is to be a woman, to act and behave in a certain way.
Okay, the word woman, but she's talking about the word woman. Is that important to make that distinction? Would be something else.
Well, I think good. So on anyone's view, there's a distinction between females and women. So we sometimes use the word female to pick out women and girls.
Uh-huh.
But we often use female to pick out a much broader class of things, which include cats and fish and a whole bunch of other
animals. Or even
animals.
Like when you plug wires into, like if you're doing like electronics and you're,
no,
right?
That, yeah, right. Excellent. No, that
it's
is...
it's a receiving end.
That's right. That is an example of what the linguists call polysemy, where words have multiple meanings and where these multiple meanings are connected in some way. They're sort of related. So another example of polysemy is the word mouse. So mouse can mean the rodent, but then it can also mean the vaguely mouse-looking, at least they were vaguely mouse-looking when they had a wire sticking out of them, handheld computer, controlling device. So that's an example of polysemy. And then, astutely pointing out, the use of male and female to refer to electrical connectors and also plumbing fixtures is another example of polysemy. But there's just a standard use of the word female on which my cat Lola is female and you are female. So Lola and Megan are both females. And in that sense, we're not talking about electrical conductors. We're talking about animals or organisms. And when we say they're female, we're saying which of the two great reproductive categories they fit into. So in that sense of female, the sense in which Lola is a female, you're a female, and some young girl is a female, obviously you should distinguish being female from being a woman, because we just have a bunch of examples of females who aren't women. For example, my cat Lola is not a woman, even though she is female.
Okay.
So you've got to distinguish female from woman. And further, at this point, when Butler is saying, at least on one interpretation, that to be a woman is a matter of repetitively acting in certain ways, she's not primarily talking about the word woman. She's just talking about women. This is what it is to be a woman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I'm assuming she talked that way about men as well. Are we?
Yes, that is.
Okay. So either way. Okay. So, I mean, but it's at some point like gender, I feel like people, and then you actually write about this in the book, like people started using gender because they like, it was just sort of a way of not saying the word sex. So sometimes like, you know, what is your gender on this form? And then it says male or female. Like how did this get so tangled up?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that, of course, gender in one sense, I mean, this is just another example of how words have, how almost every word has multiple meanings. In one sense of gender, it's a grammatical term, and you know, refers to classes of nouns primarily. So, I mean, we don't have grammatical gender in English like the French do, for example, but the word for table in French has feminine gender. So, you know, you use the definite article la as opposed to the definite article le. So there's that sense of gender, which has been around for centuries. And there's another sense of gender that you were just mentioning on which it's a synonym for sex, as in male and female. And that too has been around for centuries. That is not a recent invention at all. And the Oxford English Dictionary, in fact, lists an example of the use of gender to mean sex, as in male and female, from the 15th century, I think. So that has been established in English for ages. And very plausibly, it began to gain steam as a synonym for sex. That is, people started to use it much more often as when they meant to be talking about males and females, because people started to talk about sex in the other sense, namely sex in the getting it on or intercourse sense, much more. So they started to use the word sex to mean screwing.
Never came up before.
Yeah, they started to use the word sex, you know, unlike the Victorians who didn't really like talking about these things, people started to use the word sex to mean screwing. And now, to avoid confusion, there's sort of linguistic pressure to have some other word if you want to talk about males and females. And it so happened that there was a word already in English which meant males and females, namely gender. So that's why people started to use gender to talk about sex. And people were doing that quite frequently in the 60s. So if you wanted to make a distinction between sex as in male and female and something else, if you wanted to distinguish, for example, being female from being feminine, or being female from obeying society's rules for females or something like that, then like the worst possible word to pick to make that distinction would have been gender, because gender already had this established use in the 60s and 70s on which it meant sex. So if you want to distinguish sex from something else, for God's sake, don't use the word gender for the something else, because gender is already used to mean sex. So it was bound to end in tears. It was absolutely bound to end in tears. The whole thing was like totally screwed from the start.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So another thing I really like that you do in this book is you explain how we got so confused about the relationship between intersex conditions and transgender identities.
Oh, right. Yeah.
About Anne Fausto-Sterling, who, funnily enough, when I was doing the stint at University of Iowa in 2017, she came through and did a big lecture and was, I remember talking about how there are as many people who are intersex as there are left-handed people or red-haired people, or I can't, you know, she has a number of analogies. And so, you know, Colin Wright has been on this podcast. We've talked about this. And so there's a range of conditions that get classified as intersex, but most of them are pretty negligible. So tell us what we need to understand better about this.
So in a paper called The Five Sexes, which he published in 1993, if I'm remembering correctly, congenital adrenal hyperplasia is given as an example of an intersex condition. And she says, or strongly suggests in that paper, that these people are neither male nor female. And it's called an intersex condition. It's a DSD, but it's also an intersex condition because you do get a certain kind of sexual ambiguity, or you can get a certain kind of sexual ambiguity. That is, you have, you know, someone who has XY chromosomes and a uterus, but male-looking genitalia. But if you just look at the literature on congenital adrenal hyperplasia, it's completely clear that these people are just females. They're just straightforwardly females, right? There's no scientific literature where people are saying, gosh, you know, these XX people with CAH, these are really amazing because these are examples of humans who are neither male nor female, or both male and female, or something like that. They are just clearly females who have an excess of testosterone exposure from their adrenals.
But are they like stronger? But do they? How does this manifest for them?
Well, no, it is no. The girls with CAH. I mean, you shouldn't sort of exaggerate the degree to which genitalia are masculinized. Obviously, I mean, sorry. In some cases, the masculinization can be quite extreme. But in many cases, you know, it's not so extreme. It's just a longer clitoris or something like that. But interestingly, CAH girls, when they grow up, there's a lot of research on CAH girls, their play styles tend to be more masculine, more boy-like than control girls who don't have CAH. So that's one piece of evidence for the idea that testosterone exposure in the womb drives male typical behavior in childhood. They're also more likely to be lesbians, I believe.
Okay, so what about castor semenya?
Okay, so castor semenya actually doesn't have a classic intersex condition, although she does have a DSD, a disorder of sex development. Her condition is 5-alpha reductase deficiency. So 5-alpha reductase deficiency is a deficiency in an enzyme, not surprisingly called 5-alpha reductase. And what 5-alpha reductase does is converts the hormone testosterone into a much more powerful androgen dihydrotestosterone, which is responsible for the growth of the penis and the external genitalia in babies. So if you have 5-alpha reductase deficiency and you're XY, you have testicles, they're pumping out testosterone, the testosterone is masculinizing you, but because some of that testosterone is not converted to this more potent androgen, when you're born, your external genitalia look pretty female-like. So these people are often sexed and raised as girls. Okay, so then when puberty comes around and you get this other big burst of testosterone from the testicles, what often happens is because the burst of testosterone is so great that you do get some noticeable penile growth, even if you lack this enzyme 5-alpha reductase. So often what happens is, you know, the girl, in scare quotes, who was, you know, thought to be a girl, who was like called Julie when she was growing up, now becomes Jack and now has a, you know, sprouting, somewhat stunted penis and the musculature of an adolescent boy, and then just goes on and lives life as a man. That is the condition that castor semenya has.
Okay, but are they fertile? Can they reproduce?
I think so. At least in some cases. I mean, sometimes you don't get so much of a sprouting penis at puberty. I don't know what's really going on with castor, but the crucial thing about castor is that you know, in the press, she's often described as, oh, you know, she's just a woman with high testosterone levels, but that is really not true. She's a male with male typical levels of testosterone. She's just deficient in this one enzyme.
Right. Okay. So, all right. Well, so the point of going through all of this is to look at how intersex conditions have gotten all jumbled up in this conversation. And a lot of people who say sex and gender is a construct, that you can change sex.
Yeah.
Say, well, the fact that intersex people exist and there are so many of them prove that this is so. A lot of trans activists will talk about third genders and cultures like the Fafafine, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Right.
So as you were looking at all of this, what sort of stuck out to you as kind of the biggest logical fallacies? I mean, obviously there are many when it comes to this subject, but what do you sort of find the most egregious or surprising?
Well, I think the most egregious thing is really just what you were saying about jumbling up intersex people or people with disorders of sex development with the whole transgender thing. I mean, they really have almost nothing to do with each other. I mean, having a certain DSD, it is true, having some DSDs, it's true, can increase your chances of developing gender dysphoria. And so transitioning from one sex to the other, from being one sex to living as the other sex. But really, that's the only connection. Of course, most trans people just develop along physiologically normal lines and don't have any kind of disorder of sex development. So, yeah, it is the most bizarre thing about this whole discourse that the transgender issues are just jumbled up, mixed in with these completely separate issues about intersex people or people with DSDs. It's just bizarre how the connection is drawn between these topics that have essentially absolutely nothing to do with each
other.
Yeah,
well, the same way the connection is drawn between homosexuality and transgender identity.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, it's, that is right.
I mean there's some crossover.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really like the way you dig into so many different categories or kind of on-ramps into a transgender identity. There are cases like Jazz Jennings, which maybe we can talk about for a minute, where, you know, a child would identify at a very young age or show certain characteristics at a very young age and then is treated. There's autogynephilia, which is now starting to be talked about more, but was totally verboten for a really long time and denied by a lot of activists. I mean, what do you think of all of this, having thought about it now for so long? And I know that your book was originally supposed to be published by Oxford University Press,
yes,
and they changed their mind, so we can talk about that too. I don't know if autogynephilia was the last straw or what it was, but I mean, how are you feeling just about these topics and where they are in the discourse at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, the case of autogynephilia is particularly interesting.
That was the first half of my conversation with MIT professor Alex Byrne about his new book, The Trouble with Gender. To hear the rest, go to megandom.substack.com and become a paying supporter. I'll remind you that if you join at the founding member level, you get to attend periodic Zoom hangouts with me where we discuss the podcast and anything else on your mind within reason. And this is a great time to become a founding member because our next hangout is Sunday, March 17th. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest. Thanks for listening. See you then.